I want to speak about Hanukkah, obviously. I want to start with two prefaces before we get into what exactly Hanukkah is supposed to teach us. Let me start with a Gemara. The Gemara says that Ner Hanukkah that you put higher than 20 amos, about 30 to 40 feet in the air, above ground level, is pasul. You're not yotzei the mitzvah. Right after that, the Gemara says the following: Habor reik ein bo mayim, that when they threw Yosef into the pit was empty, there was no water in it. So Chazal say it's redundant. If it was empty, that means there was no water. So it's coming to tell me it was empty of water, but there were snakes and scorpions in the pit. So the obvious question is, what's the connection between these two things? I wanted to say the following. The question could be asked, we know there's a mitzvah to publicize miracles. So why did the Torah only hint to the fact that Yosef was thrown into a pit with poisonous snakes and scorpions and survived? Tremendous miracle happened. Why didn't the Torah publicize that miracle and put it in big letters, Neis Gadol Hayakan, Yosef was thrown into a pit with snakes and scorpions? Why did the Torah hide it and only refer to it in a hint, in a very subtle way? I think the answer is because the idea of publicizing miracles is not to publicize that God can do phenomenal tricks. Because whatever you'll say God did, he could always do better. What's the big deal? God makes oil burn 8 days. Big deal. God could make oil from nothing. He could make vinegar burn. So the fact that he can make oil burn 8 days is no great credit to God's name. No matter what you say. God could save Yosef from poisonous snakes and scorpions. Big deal. God could create or make disappear snakes and scorpions. He can create people. So what is the purpose of miracles? Not to let us know that God can do phenomenal things, but sometimes we need a lesson. And God knows that if he doesn't attract our attention with something phenomenal, we're not going to learn that lesson. So the purpose of a miracle is to attract our attention to learn a lesson. And therefore a miracle that no one learns anything from, which basically only is there to tell you that God can do tricks, we don't publicize. Therefore, the miracle that happened to Yosef, nobody learned anything from. Either the brothers didn't know there were snakes and scorpions, or they ignored it, and they sold him anyway. So a miracle that no one learns anything from is not publicized. Therefore, Ner Chanukah that you put higher than 20 amos is possible. Because you can see a Ner Chanukah 40 feet up, but you'll only see it intermittently. Every once in a while you'll look up and remember there was a big miracle. But if it's not in your line of vision, you won't think about it and understand what it comes to teach you. So therefore, that's not kosher. Because just to know there was a miracle, that God can make oil burn 8 days, that's not the purpose. The purpose is, as the Rambam says, when he describes the idea of Pirsumei Nisa, mitzvah laharos, a mitzvah to show, ulegalos es hanes, and to uncover and reveal what the nes is all about. So that is the first preface. If we are to understand a miracle properly, it's not just to be dazzled by the fact that God can do something out of the ordinary. But there's a reason for it. There's something you're supposed to learn from it. Okay. I wanted to say that that answers another question. In last week's Sedra, Yosef was called upon to interpret Paro's dream. So he interpreted the dream. There are going to be 7 good years, 7 bad years, and so on. Then he gives Paro advice what he should do. Who asked him for advice? Where did that come from? So it could be that since having a dream like this is a miracle, right, and see the future, God doesn't do miracles unless you learn something from it and act upon it. So therefore Yosef's interpretation of the dream included also what to do with it. Because if you don't know what to do with it, there's no purpose of the miracle. So therefore Yosef felt mandated to tell Paro what to do, because that was part of the interpretation of the dream itself. Okay, that's the first preface. If there's a miracle, the purpose of the miracle is to attract our attention to a certain lesson that we need to learn. Second preface. Imagine somebody walking down the street minding his own business, and somebody with an iron pole comes and breaks both his legs. The person is now writhing in pain on the sidewalk with both legs broken. The person with the iron pole comes over him and says, "I mean you no harm. I'm just an orthopedic surgeon who needs practice. So I broke your legs. I'm going to take you to my clinic. I'm going to set your legs and heal you. And in 6 months, you're going to be walking like nothing ever happened. I'm not going to charge you." And he does that. In 6 months, the person's walking like nothing ever happened. How much of a thank you does he owe that orthopedic surgeon? Nothing. He owes him a lawsuit. Why? Because if you didn't break my legs, I'd be walking like nothing ever happened 6 months earlier, because nothing would have happened. So don't break my legs and don't heal me. Why do I have to thank you? If you think about it, that raises a tremendous question of why we celebrate Hanukkah, or Purim, or Pesach, or any yontif that celebrates God saving us from some kind of calamity, from some kind of misfortune, right? Who runs this world? God. God could have prevented the Greeks from doing anything against us, but he didn't. He let them make their decrees, and he got us into hot water. And then he came and saved us. So why do we thank him? Don't break my legs. Don't heal me. God got us into... Who got us into Egypt? God. Who got us out of Egypt? God. Very nice. You could have prevented not getting us into Egypt. Why did you put us in and take us out? Who gave Haman the ability to come against us? God. Don't give him the ability to come against us. Don't save us from him. So why do we owe him a thank you? I didn't come here to convince you not to celebrate Hanukkah. So there's an answer. The answer is that my marshal is not a good marshal. And the fitting marshal would be the following. Imagine a disease of the legs that has the following pathology. I made up this disease, but I made up with the Hafnins. I can make up anything I want for my Mishalim in this shiur. That's part of the contract. So I made up this disease. It has the following pathology. It incubates for 10 years in your legs. You don't even know you have it. Only an expert can see by the way the person walks that he has this disease. Exactly to the second, from the time the person gets the disease and it incubates for 10 years to the second, the bones of the leg disintegrate and the person's a cripple the rest of his life. There's no cure. No more bones. There's only one cure to this disease. If you catch it before the 10 years and you break the person's legs and reset them, they'll grow back normal. Now let's go back to the guy walking down the street. Unbeknownst to him, he has this disease. And the orthopedic surgeon behind him is an expert, sees that he has a disease, and he also sees that there's exactly 3 minutes left until the 10 years is up. What does he have to do? Find an iron pole and break his legs pronto. And that's what he does. And he goes over to the guy and says, "You're a very lucky man." He says, "Can you explain to me why I'm lucky with two legs broken?" He says, "Yeah, because in 3 minutes, you would have been a cripple for life and there'd be no cure. I broke your legs. I'm going to take you to my clinic. I'm going to set them. In 6 months, you're going to be walking like nothing ever happened. I'm going to charge you for it." Now does he owe him a thank you? Not only does he owe him a thank you for setting his legs, he owes him a thank you for breaking his legs too. Because had he not broken his legs, the result would have been much, much worse. Sometimes we become spiritually ill, individually, collectively, nationally, and the only cure is to break our legs. The Rabbanu Shalom knows that if he lets things just go the way they are, the results will be tragic. But the only cure to the malady, the spiritual malady, is to put us into a tzara, to permit Goyim to put us into a tzara. God doesn't cause them to put us in the tzara. They're going to get punished for it. But he doesn't prevent it because we need our legs broken. And we'll discuss how that works by Hanukkah in a second. And therefore, when we come out of the misfortune, we have to thank God not only for saving us, but for putting us into the tzara too. Because breaking the legs and healing them were both necessary. And that's why the Rabbeinu Yonah says, when a person experiences misfortune and is delivered from it, he should thank God not only for the deliverance, but for the misfortune too. Because if you don't appreciate that there's a purpose for the misfortune, then there's no purpose to thank God for the deliverance. Don't get me into the misfortune. Don't take me out of it. And that's the Sfas Emes says, that on Hanukkah we say Hallel and Hodah. Hallel is for the deliverance, for the Yeshua, for the salvation. And Hodah is an admission that we needed the tzara. We needed the misfortune. So we thank God for both the misfortune and for the deliverance from it. And I think that it's hinted to in the word nes. The word nes is two letters, nun samach. The Gemara says in Brachos that the nun represents nefila, falling. And the samach is somech Hashem l'chol anoflim, God supports those that fall. The nes, which usually a miracle occurs to save us from some misfortune, includes both parts, the falling and the support. Both of them are crucial to understand. So now we have two prefaces. One is, in order to really appreciate a miracle, you have to understand what it comes to teach us. And in order to really understand what it comes to teach us, you have to understand the need for the misfortune and the salvation, not just one of them. Okay. So now let's see what Hanukkah teaches us, both sides. If you look at the Alanisim of Hanukkah and the Alanisim of Purim, they are pretty much have the same structure, except for one word. Let's see, Alanisim of Hanukkah starts, Bimei Matisyo ben Yochanan, Kohen Gadol, Chashmonai Vanov. Okay, introduces the era, Kohen Gadol, there was a Beis HaMikdash, who are the main players on the good side, Matisyo, Chashmonai, same thing with Purim. Bimei Mordechai ve'Esther b'Shushan Avira. It describes the period of time that we're talking about and who the good guys were, Mordechai and Esther. Okay, now that we know who the good guys were, who were the bad guys? Kisham the Malchus Yovan Harashal Amcha Yisrael. Kisham at Haman Harash, Aleim Haman Harash. Same structure. Okay, now we know who the good guys were. We know who the bad guys were. What was the problem? What did the bad guys want to do? Bikesh Lahashmid La Rogulade. Haman wanted to annihilate us. Now the next word by Hanukkah should have been Bikshu Lashkicham Torosecha. They wanted to make us forget the Torah. But the word Bikshu is missing. It doesn't say they sought, they wanted. It just says Lashkicham Torosecha. When the Yavan Empire arose, it was to make us forget the Torah. It doesn't say they wanted to make us forget the Torah. It could have said the same thing by Purim. Kishomar Aleim Haman Arasha Lashmid Larogulabi. Didn't have to say Bikesh Lashmid. Why by Purim does it say Bikesh and by Hanukkah it doesn't? So I think the answer is very simple. Haman did not present a problem until he sought and decreed to annihilate us. That was the problem. Haman wasn't the problem. His decree was the problem. Basha'en came by Yavan. Before they sought actively to do anything against us, they were already a threat to the Jewish people. Their emergence as an empire was a negative influence on the Jewish people and was already dangerous. Before they sought to do anything against us, before they directed their attention with us at all. Proof, there are many Jews who succumbed to Greek culture and became Hellenists before the Greeks made any decrees against us, before they had any connection to us at all. So Kisha'om the Malchus Yovan HaRishol Amcha Yisrael, when the Greek Empire rose over the Jewish people as an empire, that in itself was Lashkicham Torosecha. That in itself presented a danger of influence, right, on the Jewish people. Now, why? What was this influence that the essence of Yavan presented a threat, presented a danger to the Jewish people? What did Yavan represent? So Yavan represented a totally external view of the world. They didn't believe in any internal spiritual values. They only believed in external, physical, material things. They deified external beauty, external wisdom, external power and strength, right? Their whole society was wrestling and physical beauty. Even their gods were basically supermen and superwomen. They reduced their gods to human beings, except superhuman beings, with all the foibles of human beings, except in a super way. They stole, they murdered, they committed adultery one with the other. That was their gods. They created their gods in their own image. Instead of man being created in God's image, they created God in their image. So the Yavanim, and I think the word Yavan symbolizes that. Yavan is spelled with three letters, Yud, Vav, and Nun. Those three letters have no inside. They're just lines. They're totally external letters. Not only that, those three lines represent the physical world. Because when you look at the world from a physical, material standpoint, you judge it by quantity. How much? How big? When you look at the world from a spiritual standpoint, you judge it by quality. Quantity-wise, there are three generic quantities: small, medium, large. That's Yavan. Small yud, medium-sized vav, large nun. Three lines with no inside in three generic sizes of quantity, and those three lines are parallel. They never meet. The physical world with no spiritual background to it has no connection, no unity. Everything is separate to itself from a physical standpoint. The only thing that unifies things is a spiritual inner value. Not only that, but Yavan spelled backwards is noi, beauty. Because there is real beauty. Real beauty is where the physical reflects the inner spiritual beauty of something. That's real beauty. We have beautiful mitzvahs. We have even a woman's beauty is to be praised, the Vilna Gaon says, when she's a righteous woman. Because the external beauty then reflects the inner beauty. But they took noi, beauty, and they turned it upside down, inside out, backwards, and reduced it just to skin deep beauty and nothing more. So that is Yavan. And Yavan had a tremendous influence over many Jews who succumbed to the dazzle of the externals of Yavan and gave up Judaism to become Hellenists. Why? Why were the Jews vulnerable to this influence? So the Sfarim say the weakness of that generation was shenisrashlu b'avodas Hashem. They were weak and derelict in avodas Hashem. There's many ways of interpreting and explaining that. What I think it can be mean is the following. And we've explained this in the past in detail. I'm not going to go into the detail again, but just the basic idea. There's more to the Torah than just a bunch of do's and don'ts. Torah has to mold your ideas, your ideals, your values, your standards, create a lifestyle, personality. It's not just you could have the same values and standards as the rest of the world, except you have to do it kosher. So you become a glatt kosher goy, right? You eat like a goy eats, except you eat kosher, eat straight. Eating kosher has to develop a certain kind of lifestyle that's different than the secular world, different than the goyish world. And that's why we've explained in the past that basically there's one will of God that applies to a person's everything that he does in his life, except it's too difficult to relate to that directly, so God broke it down into its components called mitzvahs. Every mitzvah is a window to that all-encompassing will of God. And therefore we find that there's an idea of listening to God, lishmoa likol Hashem, and there's an idea of listening into what God said, lishmoa bikol Hashem. Listen in. What is a mitzvah supposed to teach me? That's the mitzvah. I did it. But what is it supposed to teach me about my standards, my values, my way of life? Shabbos is a very narrow mitzvah. It applies once a week with specific do's and don'ts. But Shabbos is supposed to teach you that this world is a very important place, but it's only a means to reach an end. And the end is Shabbos, is Olam Haba. 6 days you work, but you're working towards a spiritual goal of eternity. So somebody who keeps Shabbos meticulously, but every day of the week he has one goal, earn another buck, so he's listened to God, but he hasn't listened into what God intends Shabbos to teach you about your whole life. So Jews who only saw an external view of Yiddishkeit, do's and don'ts, do this, don't do that, but they didn't see the inner beauty of what Judaism is, the way of life of Judaism, they were very much dazzled by the externals of Greece. Because honestly speaking, the externals of Greece are a lot more impressive than the externals of the Torah. But Jews who appreciated the inner value of Torah, the way of life that Torah represents, the kind of personality that Torah is supposed to engender, so you'll excuse the pun, but the inner beauty of what's it called, of Torah, is so grand and so beautiful that the externals of Greece can't hold a candle to that. Right? So the people who understood and appreciated the inner values of Yiddishkeit were not affected by the Greeks. It's the people who only saw the externals of Torah were affected by the externals of Greece. And many of them became Hellenists. Now, Chafetz Chaim says, if that, he doesn't say it about Hanukkah, he says it in general. But I'm going to apply it over here, something the Chafetz Chaim says. If that situation would have remained, then there would have been a lot of attrition from the Jewish ranks. Many Jews would have been affected, maybe most Jews, and would have become influenced and Hellenized. So God said, the Jews are sick. They need to have their legs broken. And then I can set them and heal them. What was this breaking of the legs? So this is where the Chafetz Chaim says, many times, if a person doesn't appreciate what he has, and because of that he ignores it, and may end up losing it, the way to get him to appreciate it is to have someone threaten to take it away from him, or to actually take it away. What you have, you take for granted. What you're threatened to have been taken away, or is taken away from you, that's what you appreciate. For 2,000 years, we've been begging the Rabbanu to give us back a Beis HaMikdash. When we had it, we took it for granted, and we didn't appreciate it. Most people, unfortunately, don't appreciate their parents till they're no longer here. And then they say, oh, why didn't I appreciate them, or whatever. So, it's the nature of people. So sometimes the Rabbanu wants to break our legs by permitting Goyim. He doesn't make the Goyim do this. They do it on their own volition, they'll be punished for it. But he doesn't prevent them. He permits them to make decrees, to threaten to take away what we have and don't appreciate, in order that we should appreciate it. So that's the reason for the misfortune. We need that those decrees to make us be aware of what we have, so we'll appreciate it and not ignore it, and then we can be healed. Because if we didn't have that sorrow, we didn't have that misfortune, our legs weren't broken, the aftermath, if things had just continued on normally, would have been tragic. So therefore, the Rabbanu Shel Olam permitted the Yevanim to make decrees against us, and those decrees basically were to take away the inner value of Torah. How so? What were the things that they decreed against? First of all, they said, Lashkicham Torasecha, to make us forget the Torah. They weren't so much opposed to the written Torah. You can't forget the written Torah, it's written. They were opposed to the oral Torah, to the Mishnah. Because the written Torah is stories and do's and don'ts. That's basically what the Chumash is. You can look at it like folklore, right? They learn it in the secular public schools here as folklore, right? As literature. Very dry, external, not too impressive. The Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, puts life into it. That's why the Mishnah is the same osios as neshama. Because it is the neshama of the Torah. It makes it a way of life. So they wanted to obliterate that. Lashkicham Torasecha. And next, La'avira Mechuke Ritzonecha. In modern Hebrew, a ha'avara is transfer. You want to transfer funds from one account to another, you make a ha'avara. They wanted to transfer us from doing mitzvahs as Chuke Ritzonecha, as an expression of God's will, to just doing a bunch of do's and don'ts. Folk customs. You can have your customs. You can have your folklore. As long as your style of living is Greek. So you want to eat kosher? Just eat like a Greek. But it shouldn't become a way of life. Different than our way of life. So the first two general things were, Lashkicham Torasecha, forget about the oral Torah. Don't make the Torah a way of life. And La'avira Michuke Ratzonecha, don't make your mitzvahs something that's a way of life, just a bunch of do's and don'ts, customs, folk customs. And that's why they specifically decreed against five things, three that you're familiar with, and two that the Rambam adds based on Midrashim. Shabbos is one thing they want to obliterate, because the 6 days of the week are the physical body of the world, the infrastructure. Shabbos adds a neshama to the world, spiritual purpose to the world. They wanted to take that spiritual purpose out. Bris Milah, the body is a physical entity. What connects it to God? The symbol is Bris Milah. They wanted to separate the body from the neshama, just the body, just externals. And Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh is time. Time is also a structure, external. Rosh Chodesh says you can infuse time with a neshama, with holiness. Those are the three things they wanted to take away. Shabbos, Bris Milah, and Rosh Chodesh. The Rambam adds two other things. Women, they made a gzera that any woman who wants to get married has to first have relations with the Greek general of the place, to totally secularize and desecrate the holiness of marriage and reduce it just to a physical act. Her first experience was with this goy. And that would set the stage for everything after that. And married women were not allowed to go to the mikveh. They took away the purity of marriage. Why dafka women? Because from a secular standpoint, women are basically judged on their external attributes. Even in this modern, liberated, progressive world, there's still Miss America, Miss Universe, Miss Israel pageants. And even though they claim that, you know, they're much more refined, and they have the women speaking about their careers and reading their poetry, but they do it in bathing suits, which has me believe that's not the careers and the poetry, that's the ikker. So that's a secular Greek look at women. From the Torah standpoint, women are the foundation of the holiness of the Jewish people. And that's not just something I'd said to make the women feel good, it's true. What is the only factor that determines if somebody is born with a holy Jewish neshama or not? What is the only factor that determines that? Who your mother was. If your mother was Jewish, your father could have been Genghis Khan, you have a Jewish neshama. If your father was not Jewish, if your father was Jewish, but your mother wasn't Jewish, you don't have a neshama kedosha. And up until recently, right, mothers were women. So therefore women are the foundation of what's it called, of Kedushas Yisrael. So therefore they decreed against women. And the second thing, the next thing, the fifth thing, was money. Jewish money. Because money from a, we learned this the last year, if you remember, about a month ago, not more, tzaddikim, their money is more precious than their body. Because they see money as a function of being able to serve God with it, just like their body. And you have to put more effort into getting your money, so it's more precious. A Jewish look at money is, what's its function? What do you use it for? That's what gives us importance. From a secular standpoint, money intrinsically is important. If you have it, you're powerful. You're rich. Makes you important. You don't have to use it. Just have it in the bank. Makes you an important person. So they wanted to, they made a decree that any Jew who owned any physical property, a tape recorder, anything, had to inscribe on it, Ein lanu chelik b'elokei Israel. We have no share in the God of Israel. This money is not connected to anything spiritual. Right? Unlike the dollar, which says, in God we trust, right? They wanted you to make sure that you had no connection with God, even though that God we trust means the dollar. That's the God it refers to. But in any case, that's what they wanted to do. Divest yourself of any connection. This money is only physical. So those are the things, and that's why by the Yevanim, they weren't interested in destroying the Jewish people or destroying the Beis HaMikdash. Two words are used by Yavan, letame ulechalel, to defile and to desecrate. Now those are basically Greek words. So what do they really mean? What's lechalel? The word halal means empty space. Halal hashamayim. It means a dead body, because it's just a hollow body with nothing inside. A chalil is a flute, right, because it's hollow. And in fact, I think that the etymology of the word hollow comes from the word halal. Ches lamed lamed, H-O-L-L. Especially if you're Russian, then for sure, their mom is the same. Right, hollow and what's it called, and halal, right, is the same word. So that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to hollow out the world, take out any inner spiritual value, and that's Tumah. Wherever there was Kedusha and the kedusha left, the vacuum that's formed, is tumah. Either it's filled with tumah, or that in itself is tumah. That's what the Yevanim wanted to do. And then it says in the Al Anisim, "V'ata barachamecho harabim omadeto alohem be'esh tzorason." Doesn't say that by Purim. It says by Purim that you confounded Haman's plans. Here it could have said the same thing. It says you stood for them in the time of their tzara, meaning the folly. What was the purpose of the tzara? To make the Jews appreciate what they didn't appreciate until the Goyim wanted to take it away and make zera. You want to take it away, we'll appreciate it. Now we want it. We didn't think about it, we ignored it when we had it. Now you want to take it away from us, now we begin to appreciate it. Now we'll fight for it. So God stood by, stood on the side, and he be'esh tzorasam when he brought this and permitted the Greeks to bring this tzara, and he waited to see, are they going to now appreciate it and be willing to fight for it? Then I'll save them. Then the legs were broken, there's a purpose, now they can be saved. If not, then the purpose wasn't served. So amarat olahem be'esh tzorasam, and then rafto es rivam, when they were willing to fight for the things that they didn't consider important before, and they're willing to make a din, danto es dinam, nakamtes nikmasam, when God saw that now we cared and we're interested enough to fight for it, then he redeemed us. Now the breaking of the leg served its purpose, now I can heal them. And then what's it called? So that was the idea of Amadatolahem Be'isarasam. And therefore the Rabban Shom then said, now there's no more purpose to keep them within this Torah. So he aroused the spirit of the Chashmonaim, who contained within them all of the qualities to go against what the Greeks wanted to take away. They had the appreciation of these things and the power to go against the Greeks. The word Chashmonai represents all the decrees that the Yevonim wanted to make against us. The Chashmonaim embodied the antithesis of that. Ches Chodesh, Rosh Chodesh. Shin Shabbos. Mem Mishnah Mila Mamon. The other three zeros. Nun Nida. Aleph Eshesish. All the decrees that the Yevonim wanted to make are included in the word Chashmonoim, hinted to there. And therefore, the people who fought the Greeks were not the kings, not the warriors, but the Kohanim. It was a spiritual force that won over the Greeks, not a physical force, because that was the purpose of the Nes. The purpose of the Nes was to teach us that when there's a conflict between spiritual and physical, it's a spiritual that's more significant than the physical. And that's what it says in the Al Anisim. Giborim biat chaloshim, rabim biat meatim, tmeim biat tahorim, rishoyim biat tzadikim, zeidim biat oskei sorasecha. The Rabban Shom delivered the strong and the many in the hands of the weak and the few, and the righteous, the wicked in the hands of the righteous, and so on. Now I understand it's a miracle if the few and the weak win over the many and the strong. But where is there a miracle that the righteous win over the wicked? Is it some kind of unwritten natural law that wicked people always win? And if the righteous people win, it's a miracle. Why is that part of the miracle? But I was thinking that's not what it means. What it means is the following. We did not win because we were few and weak. We won despite the fact that we were few and weak. So why did we win? Because they had the physical edge. They were many and powerful. We had the spiritual edge. We were righteous and pure and studied Torah. So we had the spiritual edge. They had the physical edge. When it came into conflict, which one was more significant? The spiritual won over the physical. That is what the Nes of Hanukkah is supposed to teach us. And that is exactly the miracle of the oil. It doesn't make a difference how much oil you have. Quantity is not the ikar. It's quality. If it's pure, it'll last as long as you need. If it's not, it's worthless. That is the lesson that we're supposed to learn from the miracle of Hanukkah. What is significant in this world? Not the externals. The internals are more significant. And that is the symbol of the menorah. In last week's Haftorah, the Rabban Shom shows Zechariah Hanavi the menorah, and he says to him, what do you see? And he says that the symbol is of the menorah is lo b'chayil v'lo b'koach ki im baruch yomar Hashem. It's not numbers and it's not physical strength, it's my spirit. I always was wondering, how does the menorah symbolize that? But this year I thought very simply. The menorah is a very valuable kli, solid gold, very beautiful. It has all kind of pomegranates and cups and all different kinds of designs, a beautiful kli. But it's worthless, and its whole purpose is that you fill it with oil and light the candles on it. But if you don't use it for its purpose, it's a menorah that's not used for its purpose, worthless. So what do you see from there? All the beauty and all the wealth and all of their strength is only valuable if it's used as a means to bring out that spiritual flame. If it's not used for that, then what's the purpose of the menorah? All of that physical beauty and physical worth is for the sake of bringing out that flame. And that is what's it called, the idea of the menorah represents the fact that the Shekhinah, the light of the menorah, that the Shekhinah resides in Klal Yisrael. And that's the main thing. It's more important than the beauty and the wealth of the menorah, because its whole purpose is to bring out that light. And that's why in the Alanishim of Hanukkah, it mentions the word Gadol 4 times. Whereas in the Alanishim of Purim, it doesn't mention the word Gadol even once. It says, Kohen Gadol, Ulucho Asisa Shem Gadol, Ulamcho Yisrael Asisa Teshua Gadola, Lahodos Ulahala Lashimcho HaGadol. Yefes, who was the ancestor of Greece, is called HaGadol. Because from a secular standpoint, Gadol is quantity. But from a spiritual standpoint, Gadol has nothing to do with quantity. It has to do with quality. The Kohen Gadol. How did they determine who the Kohen Gadol was? They weighed all the Kohanim and measured them, and the fattest, tallest Kohen became the Kohen Gadol? Of course not. I remember when I was in Miami. I grew up in Miami. So there were no great Gedolim who lived in Miami. So when I first went to Tells, I spent my first Ben Hazmanim in New York. I wanted to go see Rav Moshe Feinstein. Still alive at the time, I wanted to see what a gadol looks like. So they took me to the Lower East Side, and for a block away they said, you see that guy in the distance, that's Rav Moshe Feinstein. I remember as a 17-year-old thinking to myself, Rav Moshe Feinstein didn't come up to my shoulders. He's a little guy. I remember thinking to myself, if those are the gedolim, what do the ketanim look like? But he wasn't a gadol because he was a basketball player. His godless was quality, not quantity. So that's what Hanukkah teaches me. What is gadol? From Greek standpoint, gadol is a lot, quantity. And from our standpoint, it's quality. And that is exactly what we state when we sing Mo's Sur. We stand by our candles and we sing about all the empires that don't exist anymore. They're not standing by any candles singing about us. They're in the history books. And they had everything physically going for them. Land and power and armies and wealth. And they're no longer around. We didn't have any of that. What do we have? Those candles. That inner spiritual power. We're still around. They're not around. That's what Mo's Sur represents. That is the message of Hanukkah. That's why it says, Amcho Yisrael Asisa Teshua Gedolo Furkan Kayom Hazeh. You made a salvation till today. Whenever we say Alanisim, it's till today. What's left of Hanukkah till today? Hanukkah was a rededication of the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have any Beis HaMikdash. It was the renewal of the Malchus Yisrael, the Chashmonaim, royalty. We don't have any royalty today. So what's left from Hanukkah? The answer is, what's left from Hanukkah is every year we can recharge our batteries with the ability to learn from the miracle, to appreciate that inner spiritual value we have, and not to be dazzled and influenced by the externals of the world, which Western society is basically the heirs to Greek civilization. And we shouldn't be influenced that that's the main thing in this world, the externals. The main thing is the internals. That's what still remains from Hanukkah, the ability every year to relearn that lesson and recharge our batteries to be able to survive against it. Which also explains the following. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael 30 years ago, maybe some of you experienced the same thing, since we all basically came from somewhere else. But in America, and I imagine in England also, the food of Hanukkah is latkes. Whereas my daughter in Scotland says they don't call it latkes, they call it latkes. So latkes, okay, latkes, whatever you want to call them, right? That is the food of Hanukkah. It's Hanukkah, you eat latkes. My wife, we used to be the dorm supervisors and tells. My wife used to bake 2,000 latkes and give them out at night in the halls to the guys because they couldn't go home and they felt homesick, so a nice home-baked latke was something. Came to Eretz Yisrael. Come to my first Hanukkah party in Eretz Yisrael on the Moshav. No latkes. What do they serve? Jelly donuts. Sufganiyot. What is a culture shock? What in the world does jelly donuts have to do with Hanukkah? Same thing the second day and the third day. Every party I went to, no latkes, only sufganiyot. And it was really disheartening. Until the third day of Hanukkah, I remember I passed by an army base near us, Mitkan Adam. There was a big billboard with one word on it and an arrow pointing towards the base. And that one word was latkes. So I said, wow, at least in the army they preserve the meaning of eating latkes. And they even tell you where to go. And the guy with me said, no, that says latkes. In any case, but after 30 years of thinking about it, I realized that the Israeli minig is more significant than the Chutzlaretz minig. Why do we eat latkes? Because they're fried in oil. Right? So it's reminiscent of the miracle of the oil. I'm sure if you took a wick and put it into a latke, it would last for 8 years, not just for 8 days. So, sufganiyot, same thing, they're fried in oil. So, but there's something more significant about a sufganiyah. What's the message of a sufganiyah? It's not what's on the outside that's the ikr, it's what's on the inside. That is exactly the lesson of Hanukkah. Now, that's what we're supposed to learn, and that's why Hanukkah, you would think, where should be the mitzvah of lighting the menorah? In shul. Where was the menorah? We rededicated the temple, and we're able to relight the menorah. What today is the symbol of the temple? The shul. Mikdash Ma'at. Why isn't the mitzvah of Hanukkah to light the menorah in shul? And the fact that we do light a menorah in shul is only a custom. Nobody's yotze with that. It's not a halacha. It's only a custom. The halacha is you must light in your home. Ner Ishu Beso. Why? Why do we light it at home? Right in the shul, where it would like the Beis HaMikdash. You're lighting the menorah in the symbol of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the answer is the Beis HaMikdash was only the external means to get God's presence amongst the Jewish people, not in the temple. V'yosu li mikdash v'shachanti bisocham, not bisocho. It doesn't say I'll dwell in it, I'll dwell amongst you. Where? In the heart of every Jew. But more specifically, where is God's presence devolve? From the Mikdash, not in the Mikdash. Where does it devolve? In the Jewish home. How do I know? Because where is God's presence in the Mikdash? Mibein shnei akruvim. Between the two kruvim. The kruvim, one was male, one was female, represents a husband and wife. Ish ve'isha shchina shruya b'neihem. And they had the faces of children. The whole family's there. That's where the Shechina is. So if you want to know where the continuation of the light of the menorah is, it's not in the Mikdash. It's not in the shul. It's in the home. And that's why we light the menorah at the doors of the home, or inside the home, according to the minig of Chutzlar, it's inside. But here in Eretz Yisrael, outside the home, by the door, because if you have that tremendous light that you've created in the home, then you can open the door and illuminate the world around. So that is the idea of Hanukkah. That's why we needed the Tzara, because we had a very external view of the Torah, and we needed our legs broken and have it threatened to be taken away by the Greeks in order to appreciate it. Once we appreciated it, the Rabban Shlom then did miracles for us to attract our attention to the fact that that's what the Ikar of the world is, and that's what the miracle of Hanukkah is all about. To remind us, it's not the externals of this world that are the main thing, but the internal spiritual values and power is much more significant than the external physical powers of the world. Okay.